Welcome to Satellite Sisters, sisters and misters, and especially hello to new listeners of Satellite Sisters. We welcome you. This is our Friends and Fiction special. We were so happy to get to know these dynamic women over the last year, and we interviewed all five of the Fab Five in 2021, Lee, and it was exciting.
Yeah, on today's show, we have three authors, Mary Alice Monroe, Kristen Harmel, and Christy Woodson Harvey. Okay, three new books out, but they have three totally different life stories. I am telling you, these are such fun interviews. I loved doing them. It was great talking to Mary Alice, Kristen, and Christy. But in the course of 2021, we have also spoken to Mary Kay Andrews and Patty Callahan Henry. So you can click the show notes there and check out where those shows are. But this was a super fun show to put together. Uh-huh. And we welcome all of the Friends in Fiction listeners who might be just discovering Satellite Sisters for the first time. And we would like to thank our sponsors on this show. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening to Satellite Sisters. Enjoy our Friends and Fiction special.
You're listening to Satellite Sisters.
What's a satellite sister?
The person you call when the best thing in your life happens, or the worst.
The person that gets you up, gets you going, and gets you through.
And every once in a while, changes your mind.
This podcast is part pep talk, part weekly check-in.
Like grabbing coffee with a friend.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to the Satellite Sisterhood.
You're listening to Satellite Sisters. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the second of our Summer Splash shows. I'm Leanne Dolan. I'm here with my sisters, Liz Dolan and Julie Dolan. And today, we welcome the women of Friends and Fiction. That's right. We're happy to talk to three of the Fab Five on today's podcast. Super duper Southern writers, Mary Alice Monroe, Kristen Harmel, and Christy Woodson Harvey. All three have new books out this summer, and they are all wildly different. So we'll be speaking to our Friends and Fiction friends individually. And up first is Mary Alice Monroe. Boy, she has 100 books out this summer.
Leanne, it's amazing.
I mean, we are going to talk to her about how did she write so many books during a pandemic. Mary Alice, welcome to Satellite Sisters.
Oh, hi, girls. How are you?
Good.
We are great. We're great.
Yeah. Okay, so what's happening? You had your summer, you know, bestseller, The Summer of Lost and Found Out. Now The Islanders is out. That's middle grade fiction. You also contributed to a wonderful collection of stories in memory of your late friend and wonderful writer, Dorothea Benton Frank. That was a lovely effort. And you launched Friends in Fiction. How did you do all that during the pandemic, Mary Alice?
Well, I have to say, I'm trying to figure out why I'm tired, but just listening to all that, I think I understand.
Yes, we can tell you. Yes.
I mean, that's a lot of creative output. No, I'm serious. How did you do all that?
I think it's because of the pandemic. You don't realize how much time going out and touring takes until it's gone.
Right.
And so we had a lot more time. Actually, the middle grade book I'd been writing for 2 years. So that was not just sudden. And it was just slated to come out. And when they asked me and Patty to write the short story for Dorothea, that was just an instant yes. There was just no even thinking about it. Of course we would. So it was actually my first short story. And it was a learning curve, but I really loved the story I wrote. It's based on a true story from my cousin, my husband's cousin, actually, who I knew what Munchausen by proxy was, which is a bizarre mental health problem.
Oh, yeah. I've read about that.
Where the mother tries to make the child sick from various reasons. And that happened to her. And she was adopted. And I was with her when she met her mother at 40.
Oh,
and this was just such a powerful story. And it just blended so well with my setting. The requirement was to have a beach setting. Mm-hmm. And we all could come up with any idea we wanted. So for me, this story of a mother and child reunion that happened on the beach just seemed so perfect, because the analogy for the sea turtles, you know, we nurture them, we watch the nests, and when they emerge, they go out and disappear forever. But the mother turtle in our human terms, abandons the nest. You know, she lays her egg, she's a reptile, she leaves. And I thought, wow, the parallel for releasing of a child to adoption and the reptile who naturally lays her nest and eggs and leaves was so strong that I put it together. And it just turned out, I really loved it. So that book came out and they just decided it was coming out in April. Then my novel, which was set against the pandemic, came out in May. And then my publisher decided, well, we're bringing out your middle grade book, The Islanders, in June. So it's been, wow. It's been a roller coaster of riches. But and on the other hand, I'm tired.
Well, the rest of us during the pandemic just baked bread and watched the Queen's Gambit. So, I mean, congrats.
Well, there's that too. Like, how many sourdough starters can we really use? And how much wine can we drink? Which I, there's so many great videos of people going out to their recycling bins in the morning and seeing all the wine bottles.
Yes.
Hysterical. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations, because that is a lot of productivity, but all very different projects. So yes. I really enjoyed The Summer of Lost and Found. It's, you know, classic Mary Alice Monroe, so, you know, set on the beach. There's a conservation theme running through it. It's a family saga, multi-generational, a lot of complications in all the stories. But honestly, Mary Alice, I was really surprised that you incorporated a coronavirus into the story. I thought that it was super brave because you must have been writing in real time.
Yeah, I did. And I have to say, it was both brave and naive.
Because, oh, really? Naive in what way?
You know, honestly, it seemed like a good idea at the time. What I do when I tell a story is I observe nature or wildlife, and then I pull home all together the themes and the ideas and characterizations, and I create a story. So I thought, well, here we are in an epic situation. I mean, we will look back on 2021 in the future and say, you know, this is, where were you? This is like, where were you when JFK was shot, or where were you when the Twin Towers fell? It'll be like that, and it'll spark great conversations. So I thought, fine, I'm going to study the human species in great detail this time. What I didn't count on was how my perspective of what to say in the novel, what were the major points, would change as I lived through it in real time. My ideas changed as we lived, you know, thinking, okay, by June, it'll be over. Well, right. It wasn't over in June. And by September, oh my gosh, we're getting something called variants. And it was getting long and people were dying. And those were the losses. But I also discovered, by paying really close attention to what was going on in my life, but also in the lives of my children and people I loved, there were a lot of great new changes. And one of which was, I was up in the mountain house and I invited my sister from Chicago, who is a psychotherapist who's closed down her practice. And I said, don't stay in your condo, come to the mountains. And she did. And then my sister in LA, who was locked up in her condo, I said, don't stay there, come here. And my 30-year-old niece had no job. So I said, you can stay with us too.
Wow, so we all there's were a like, book.
There's a book. Oh.
That's
oh,
a book or a podcast.
I think that's the next one that's coming out. And we all, but it was so interesting to see how we never, it's like all of you sisters, we're all living together for the summer. And, wow. You know, it's just, when can you do that? Except in this very weird Camelot moment of the pandemic, which was very positive. And my daughters were saying how they, you know, were so tired of teaching or becoming substitute teachers through the laptops all day that they turned off all electronics at night, and they played board games and they went for walks and they actually stayed in my beach house and had the best summer ever. So there were some really good moments too.
Okay. You know, Mary Alice, I think if all the Dolan sisters were together for the summer, it would be important that one of us be a psychotherapist. Yeah. I think that's the key to your operation.
Well, you know what happens when you're all together with your sisters? You go back to the nursery.
Yes.
You know, and you start having to work out some of the issues that may have formed over the years of silence or, you know, anger, subtle angers. They're all worked out because you're forced to when you live together. Okay. And that's a really wonderful observation, you know, being close together for a long period of time, you can't hide your feelings.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, we know from talking to you on Friends in Fiction for a couple of episodes this year, your wonderful online book discussion group, that you are from a big family as well. So you get the dynamics that you could not see people for years. And then all of a sudden they're in your beach house and you've got to work out anger. Liz, I don't think we should ever do that, frankly. No.
Or at least try for a weekend. It doesn't have to be a week, summer. Although it's interesting, it actually went longer. We had such a good time. They just wouldn't leave.
Leon, I think we'd have to have a plot development like you have in the Sweeney Sisters, where a brand new sister shows up. I think she would need to be a psychotherapist.
Yeah. So, with a beach house.
Someone who did not live through our childhood with us, but has an interest in helping us sort all that stuff out. I think there's the perfect twist.
And here's the key, though, at the very end of that time, you have to have a novel, and you have to also figure out what it is you learned that you want to share with everybody.
Okay.
That was hardest part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, wow. your books, almost all your books are family sagas. Is that fair to say? Like what?
I think so. The women's lives, a lot of them are family sagas. The one I'm beginning now is a family saga, but it's also, sometimes it's just one woman's life. I always am intrigued by, you know, the various relationships in women's lives, in particular friends. I think women friends are so powerful. And yet when I write a novel, I try to be very accurate and honest. And there are friendships, like a book club, for example, where there are fights and disagreements. This group that I wrote about in this novel, Lost and Found, they were friends and they're all together, but there were COVID couples and there was jealousy and there's annoyances. And brother, sister, you know, annoyances and mothers freaking out.
Yeah.
And I think that's reality. That's what makes it both amusing and poignant, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, I'm going to ask you the question we get asked all the time. Do you use your own family members in your books? Do you base any characters on siblings, or do you have the same policy I have?
Not really. The only one that I did is a book I called The Four Seasons. And it's about a group of sisters in the Midwest. And it was the only book that I drew on my experiences. And I was really careful not to name them or not to make them anybody, but clearly they were subtle. Let's put it this way. My brother called me up and said, okay, now I know who Marguerite is and I know who Ruth is. And he started naming everybody and I just laughed and remained silent.
Yeah. It's fiction.
It's fiction. But for most part, I don't like to because in my books, the character, and for all books, the character has a job to do.
Right.
And if you try to make it too close to anyone real, you fail, which is why I think it'd be really hard to write a novel based on an actual person because you have to delicately dance that line of reality versus fiction.
Yeah, I'm always surprised at historical fiction writers. Like when they get it right, when they use real people, I just think that's the hardest thing to do. I agree with you.
I would
it's
think so
much
too.
Easier to make stuff up. That's the fun part, you know.
Yeah, and they get to, you know, they're personifications of goals that you have for the story too. And so when I write like the Beach House series, for example, these characters now. I've been writing for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's sort of amazing to think about, but they've grown up. So I have to be honest and say, when I write Kara, I know her so well. She can say anything and I know I'm her in my mind when I say her words because I've been living there for 20 years. And all the characters in that series have become like family. And I don't think I'll stop that series. I'm not going to write another beach house for a little while, but whenever I have something I want to say about my beach or Charleston, I go back to this family. And you know, I always like it when I love a series. It's sort of familiar and reassuring. It's like inviting old friends back. And I've been getting a lot of that with the Summer of Lost and Found because people are, I think, feeling unsure during the pandemic and coming out of it, that it's like binge watching. You know, people love that familiarity, that consistency.
The Beach House that you referenced, that was your first, you know, New York Times bestseller. And the movie is on Hallmark Is that just so fun? Because it's on all the time. And I mean, and every time.
Oh, I'm going to have to take that in.
Oh my gosh, Liz, with Andie MacDowell. Oh, it's fantastic.
I know. Well, I have to say, that was the most fun story. I don't know if you ever heard how that happened.
No.
But when I wrote the book, The Beach House, 20 years ago, that was a big decision on my career, where I said I really was going to write books set against endangered species to try and make my audience aware. Now, I wasn't teaching, just aware of issues. And when I wrote that book, Andie MacDowell was in my head. I usually put pictures up as Kara. So okay. Fast forward 10, 12 years, and I'm in an airport going from Atlanta to Charleston. And there's the hair. I recognized her curly hair. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's Andie MacDowell. And I sat kitty corner from her in a little puddle jumper. And I didn't say anything. I was determined not to bother her. It was 11 right. o'clock at night. I wasn't going to be that author. And she came to stand next to me while we waited for our luggage. And I thought, okay, thank you, God.
This is fate.
So I said, hi, it's me. I just want to tell you that you were an inspiration for my novel. And I just want to thank you. And she was so sweet, as she is, and said, oh, well, what was the name of that book? And I said, The Beach House. And she wrote it down. And then my luggage came and I said, thank you. And I walked away. And as I was walking out, I saw this bookstore in the airport had a huge poster of my books and all my backlist in there. And I'm like, yes.
Thank oh my God.
And sure enough, she walked by and she saw the book and she checked it and she bought it. And then she called me up a couple of weeks later and said, I want to make a movie of this book.
Oh my goodness.
That is
so you know serendipity, right?
Oh my gosh.
That's fantastic. That's
the greatest story I've ever heard about a book to film adaptation.
You know? And then it became a Hall of Fame. And I grew up, you probably did too, watching the Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They were always big deals in our house. And Sarah Plain and Tall was probably my favorite. And I remember when I watched the film, I was being inducted into the South Carolina Hall of Fame that very night. I mean, it was like the greatest day of my career. And I was out in Beaufort, South Carolina, where the meeting was. And we all had to duck out after I got my award because my movie was premiering. So we went to Pat Conroy's house. And I'm sitting in Pat's big old orange comfy Barca lounger, watching the huge TV. And under the TV while I watch my movie is his Crystal Award for his Hallmark Hall of Fame, The Water is Wide. And that was a moment, I tell you, that I'll never forget.
Wow. I am so glad you shared this story. I mean, I watch
it full circle. Yeah.
I watch it like every week. It's on every week. I just like to check in with it. It's just what's up.
I'll tell Andie.
And so now that I have that backstory, it's fantastic. Oh gosh, that's a great story. That's a wonderful story. Well, I can tell you enjoyed the movie then.
I enjoyed watching making it. It's just when you see your words come alive, there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah. I did not realize until I was prepping for this interview that you wrote the screenplay as well, which is cool.
They say I did. To be totally honest with you, I got the approval and I always was annoyed that why would you change the words? I said it perfectly the first time.
Just take the credit, Marielle.
Take the credit, yes.
It's rough out here in Hollywood. Take it.
I'm grateful. No, truly, I'm grateful.
Well, okay, Mary Alice, before it's too late, I have to ask you about your conservation work, particularly in the area of sea turtles, because you don't know this about me, this is Liz, but the sea turtle is my spirit animal. I talk about sea turtles all the time. And on the Satellite Sisters Facebook group, I've often been running what I call Operation Sea Turtle, which is more of my own personal fitness program. I'm not saving any sea turtles, but I enjoy the sea turtle. And so reading all about all the work you have done as a state certified volunteer with the Island Turtle Team, I just want to thank you on behalf of other sea turtle lovers.
Well, that means a lot. I didn't know when I became involved with sea turtles as a volunteer, it'd become a lifelong career move, as well as I still am on the turtle team. I'm on the board for I work with leatherbacks in Costa Rica in the winter. I'm on the board there and I rehabilitate turtles with the South Carolina Aquarium. It's just a species. I work with a lot of different species, but the sea turtles are the ones that I'll be with love. They're ancient mariners. They're lone swimmers. There's something so remarkable about this animal that is, follows its instincts. So maybe that says a lot about you, Liz.
Okay, thank you. The lone swimmer. Okay.
Ancient mariner. Liz.
Ancient mariner, following my instincts. Well, it's so funny. Again, something else you won't know about me, but our listeners will know. I've already announced on Satellite Sisters that when I was thinking about what's my first vacation, real vacation I'm going to take once the pandemic is well and truly over, I Googled places to see sea turtles. And the first three places, I had been to all of them. Number four was Costa Rica. So that's my next vacation, is going to Costa Rica to see the
Well, you have to go then in December, January, because that's when this
okay.
good leatherbacks
January,
come ashore.
January is our target time. Okay.
Oh, perfect. Well, you go to Costa Rica, you go to, yeah, you have to go to see the leatherbacks. And they're 95% extinct, so they're many.
Wow.
But the Atlantic leatherbacks in Florida are doing quite well.
Okay. All right.
They're nesting right now. So hurry up.
Okay.
This is travel information. This is Hollywood. I mean, we have really
also I'm just gonna say, if for little children who are the stewards of tomorrow, there are sea turtles in the Islanders. That they're definitely in that book. I really feel like kids really get it. And when you say to kids, hey, the ocean is filled with plastic, they don't get sorrowful and bemoan. They're like, well, let's clean it up. Let's go do it. And they have such energy and such positive spirit that's why I wrote for them. But there are two sea turtles in that book, so be sure to read it.
Okay.
The Islanders is your first middle grade fiction I read. You know, is that why you wanted to do it? Was it a conservation message, or was that a particular audience that you feel a kinship to?
Both, actually. I had written two picture books. When I have a lot of information about a species, I try to do a picture book for kids because I get dismayed when I see information that's actually wrong for children, because they believe the printed word is true. And I was teaching in schools, and I saw that enthusiasm I just talked about with the second graders, third graders, fourth graders, a little bit older. So I wanted to write a chapter book, and I was asked to write a series for a new imprint. And I said, absolutely. A little naive there too, and nerve-wracking, because writing for children is a very different animal.
Yeah.
And I did, and I'm really grateful for the response I'm getting. I think it's been very powerful. The curriculums are adapting the book all across the country for their
schools. Oh my
gosh,
that's wonderful. Congratulations.
It's really pretty exciting. Thank you.
Oh, that's
great. You know, the whole point for that book was to show kids that you unplug, turn off the electronics, and it's okay to be bored at first, but then all of a sudden something magic happens. They start to explore and they look around, and their imagination takes off. And when that happens, they become kids, real kids, and they play. And I really encourage, for the mental health of all of us, but especially for kids, to get them outdoors, unplugged at least one day a week, you know, to say you're not going to turn on electronics. And these kids are on an island where there are no, it's a true place. It's Deweese Island, no cars, no stores, only accessible by boat. And for these kids, no Wi-Fi. And they think it's going to be the worst summer ever. But these kids meet each other and they're unlikely friends. You have an African American boy from a wealthy family in Atlanta, and you have a girl from local island who's kind of a know-it-all in nature. And then you have an army brat kid from New Jersey whose father was injured and he's stuck to live with his grandmother, which he thinks is, oh gosh. And it turns out they're good friends, and it turns out they explore, and it's the best summer ever. So I hope people will read it with their kids. And I always say this too, a lot of people who are going to learn about an animal or something they don't know, pick up a middle grade book or a young adult, because the writing is cleaner and simpler, and you can learn the lessons much more than if you were trying to read it through an adult novel. And certainly as a writer, I had to approach it that way.
Well, it sounds like a great vacation book. If people are off in August,
it is.
This will be on our summer splash show, just to read in August. Is there an audio book of this too? That also sounds
there is. I used to read my audio books, but I thought it needed a boy's voice and it needed a kid sounding voice. So I stepped aside and it turned out really well.
Okay.
It was a good decision.
I'm only relieved because now I know you can't literally do it all. I mean, you're saving species, you're writing screenplays, you're hunting down movie stars. I'm just relieved you don't do your own audio.
And I'm gaining weight. I've gained the COVID-15. So obviously I've got to work on that too.
Okay, great. I'm glad to hear it. Congratulations. So, Mary Alice, thank you so much for being on Satellite Sisters. What a delightful conversation. She's written a lot of books. She has a lot going on. And we didn't even get a chance to talk about Friends in Fiction, but I know that our Satellite Sister audience is familiar with the great work you're doing there. So thank you so much for being on and have a great summer.
Well, thank you. And I always have such a good time with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Alice.
Bye.
Liz, you know we love talking about Framebridge, don't we?
We do.
because
there are just so many fun things to frame, Leon, aren't there?
Right. Anything. You can just upload a digital photo from your phone and they can print it and frame it. And that is a gift right there, a gift people would love getting. But Liz, you recently had quite an exciting Framebridge experience. Would you like to share?
I talked about how when we were at the Bruce Springsteen concert, I was with our brother Dick, his wife Susan, his two kids, and one of the roadies threw us the set list at the end of the show, which was amazing to get the actual set list for the actual concert in Los Angeles. And we're like, oh, yeah. Any day now, that's going to be in a place of honor in their home. Sure enough, Leon, they have already frame-bridged it and sent it to us with a picture. So I'll be in Bend next week, so I'll get to see it. But it's just excellent use of the Framebridge resources, the Bruce Springsteen set list.
Fantastic. And this is gift-giving season. So if you have a graduation coming up, a wedding, a shower, Mother's Day, Father's Day, look around. I'm sure you have something fun you can frame, and Framebridge can do it for you. It's easy and it's affordable to frame just about anything. You get fair and transparent upfront pricing based on the size of your item. There's a great selection of frames. And as we've said in the past, fast service, free shipping, great for gifts. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Liz, not many things in life give you a happiness guarantee, but Framebridge does. If you're not 100% happy with your piece, they will make it right. So if this
but
sounds like...
you're going to be happy, okay? Yeah. And that's just the Satellite Sisters promise. You're going to be out. You're going to be happy you did it.
See why Framebridge has been trusted to frame over 2 million pieces. Visit framebridge.com or see a local Framebridge store to get started and custom frame just about anything, like a Bruce Springsteen set list. That's framebridge.com. Thanks, Framebridge.
Julie and Leon here, and we are so excited to welcome Kristen Harmel to Satellite Sisters. You know her as a New York Times bestselling author. She wrote The Book of Lost Names, bestseller, The Winemaker's Wife, bestseller. Her new book is The Forest of Vanishing Stars. It is really special. It is also a bestseller. But Kristen has a really fantastic backstory. So much writing, from sports writing to People Magazine to Women's Day to American Baby. I can't wait to talk to her. Kristen, welcome to Satellite Sisters.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, it's really a pleasure. Julie, we loved Kristen's new book, didn't we?
Oh, well, first of all, the title is just amazing. And yes, this is an absolutely captivating book. I really enjoyed it.
And we're going to talk more about it, the Forest of Vanishing Stars. But I wanted to start with your broad writing career, because I feel like that must all add up to these great historical fiction novels that you write. But I was surprised to read that you started your career as a sports writer. What drew you to that?
I did. And actually, what's even funnier about that is I was only 16 when I started. So, it's nuts. So, I mean, that's what I thought I wanted to do. I've always known I wanted to write novels.
Okay.
When I was a teenager, I thought, well, maybe that's not a very practical career goal right out of the gate. So I'd like to start off being a journalist, you know, because I like to write, I like to talk to people, I like to ask people questions. And those seemed like things that a journalist would do too. So I decided when I was like 15 or 16, okay, that's how I'm going to start. And then I thought, well, what's holding me back? I'll just start now. So I bought books about how to write for magazines. And they said, you know, write a query letter to a magazine and tell them what your article idea is. So I did that for local magazines, cleverly omitting my age, not lying, just not yeah. specifically mentioning, you know, that I
Kristen,
was 16.
A lot of us cleverly omit our age.
I know, I'm 42 now. So I'm at that point where I'm starting to do it on the other side of things. So. My first story that I ever pitched was about the St. Louis Cardinals, and I got to go talk to a bunch of Major League Baseball players, and I subsequently got assignments from the same local sports publication to write about the local NFL team, the local NHL team, and then some Major League Baseball teams that were in my hometown for spring training. And it was months before the editor actually met me face to face.
Oh my gosh.
His jaw just dropped, and he said, "How old are you?" And I said, 16? Is that a problem?
You know what? I can't, because I'm thinking back. I started my career in sports media too. That's why
you
this
did.
Stuck out to me.
Oh,
yes.
I had no idea.
Yes. So, and still love sports. So I was a writer and producer. And, and so I was like 22 or 23. And that's when women were first allowed into the locker rooms. But that is very intimidating. And I have to say, the players enjoyed intimidating. So were you in locker rooms when you were 16, 17?
I was. Isn't that the weirdest thing? And at the time, I just thought, well, this is normal. And anyone treating me like it's not normal is just being sexist. But like, obviously that wasn't it. I was 16 and I looked like I was 12 because I'm only 5 feet tall. And like, it's ridiculous when I look back. But yes, I was in locker rooms interviewing, you know, professional athletes like I was a grown up.
Okay, that's the screenplay I want to write.
I know. That's a movie right there.
Oh my God. But make yourself 18. So it's slightly less creepy, but I can remember.
Exactly.
I remember being in the Dodgers locker room, and I wasn't a sports journalist. I worked for a sporting goods company. So we were I did marketing stuff more. So when I first walked into the locker room and they were like 100% naked, and I was like, I don't need to do this. I don't.
Exactly.
And they, I don't want to name names, Mike Piazza, but I mean, I was like, oh my gosh, where do I look? Where am I looking?
My gosh.
Am I looking up? So that really caught my eye.
And I need to trade some stories someday, because I bet we both have some. That is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So, but then you moved to magazines and you wrote for People magazine for a long time. And I have a couple other friends that wrote for People. Was that a great training ground? I mean, because People covers everything.
It was wonderful. You know, it was nice to do a mix of that plus longer features for other magazines because, you know, People opens a lot of doors, but the articles wind up being very short. So I would say that at People, I kind of honed my interview and research skills. Mm. And it was through work at other magazines that I kind of maybe developed my writing a little bit more. Although I will say that People was fantastic for learning how to be gracefully edited. You know what I mean? Like, because you'd turn in, you know, 1,000 words and they'd be like, oh yeah, we've decided we're actually going to run this at 175 words with a large picture. And you're like, okay. So
it pays the same.
That's why we like People magazine.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. No, it was a great experience. And there were so many, you know, I did a lot of celebrity stuff there, but I would say my primary job in the years that I worked there was to do the Heroes Among Us stories.
Oh yeah.
Stories of real people doing incredible, extraordinary things. And I think there's I don't think I've realized it until recently, but I think there's a direct through line from that to the career that I'm working in now. I mean, that's really at the heart of my books, like, you know, ordinary people rising up and doing extraordinary things. And that's what I've been writing since 2000 for People.
Okay. Well, you just answered my next question, because I was going to say, has the experience of writing at People and other magazines, how has it informed your work? But that's it. You're sort of on the lookout for these ordinary people stories, huh?
I suppose, but you know, I don't think I realized until a couple of years ago that I was doing that. I don't think I, you know, because I started my novel writing career writing romantic comedies, which, mm-hmm. you know, now I primarily write historical fiction. So it's very different. And I think that with those romantic comedies kind of thrown in there in the middle, I had never really connected the dots that, you know, that like that people experience maybe was a portion of what led me to where I am today.
Well, probably all your writing just keeps building to where you
yes.
are. With,
yes.
You know, it, from 16 on. And now you're like, you have two books out this summer. The Book of Lost Names is out in paperback. That was an instant New York Times bestseller. This beautiful book, The Forest of Vanishing Stars. Both are World War II books. They're Holocaust related. Why do you, and your last, I think, three books have all, three or four, right, have all been World War II related. Why do you continue to be fascinated by that piece of history?
That is such a great question. You know, and I think that part of it is that there are so many stories that haven't been told yet. And not just stories that haven't been told, but stories that are very relevant to the world today. Mm. And stories that still hold lessons for us. You know, it is strange to me. And I do a lot of reading about World War II as well. And it doesn't often feel like I'm reading about something that happened 80 years ago. I mean, these stories feel much more modern and immediate than that. And I think a lot of the stories that still have to be told have to do with the role that women played. Mm-hmm. And I like that we're getting a chance to look at this world war that we thought we all knew from a slightly different angle with slightly different heroes or heroines, as the case may be.
Yeah. Is that, I mean, it seems like readers can't get enough of World War II. I mean, I thought, well, that trend will die out. I mean, because it's almost all the historical, there is a lot of World War II historical fiction, but maybe that's it. Maybe it's just that this is finally a chance to hear the women's side of the war. And that's so appealing to, you know, primarily female readers. Yeah. What do you hear from your readers?
You know, that is a big part of it. I think people also like to learn something without feeling like they're sitting down for a history class. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like if you can sort of enjoy the experience of the novel, become emotionally engaged, and then walk away with a little bit of a lesson at the end, maybe like a history lesson plus a life lesson, then like, hey, bonus. See, it's like three for the price of one. Right,
yeah. right.
But you know, the other thing I think about World War II is that I think that there's something really compelling about setting a story within a framework where you already know sort of the heroes and the villains, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. And in that way, it's kind of like a superhero story, right? Like when you watch a big superhero film, like, you know who you're supposed to be rooting for, but it's what the storyteller does, I think, in all of that gray area in between, I just think you have the opportunity to kind of make things really interesting on that big stage. So,
I mean, that's, I like that framework.
Yeah,
a superhero movie. I like it.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah.
You know, Kristen, in The Forest of Vanishing Stars, what I found so enchanting were the vivid descriptions of how the characters learn to live in the forest. I mean, I wrote this kind of as a joke question. Did you attend an Outward Bound course? Because the level of detail there is so vivid that you must have known a lot about living in the forest. Is that true?
Well, you know, we're doing this podcast from my hut in the forest right now. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, now that I know you were a 16-year-old sports reporter, I think it's quite possible you could have a hut in the forest.
That
you
exactly. it's a great question. And I will say that the research for this book was really interesting, and I was really lucky to have a couple of sources, human sources, like actual people who helped me a lot. So, you know, I did a ton of reading about how specifically Jewish refugees survived in the forest during World War II, which is what this book kind of centers mm-hmm. around, the true story of Jewish refugees surviving in the forest. But in addition to that, I got to talk to a man named Aaron Bielski, who is 94 now, And he's the youngest of the Bielski brothers, who were the most famous and well-known group of Jewish refugees who hid in the forests of Poland. Oh, so wow. He actually did survive the war this way, spent years in the forest living off the land as part of a society that he and his brothers built. I mean, the real story is fascinating. I mean, it's almost unbelievable. But in addition to that, I was able to work with a Belarusian forest guide who knows the forest I was writing about inside and out. He has a PhD. He leads expeditions into the forest. And I probably sent him dozens of questions each week. And I paid him for his time. I would have felt horrible otherwise. But he was like basically my research source for everything. If I needed to know what mushrooms grew in this area of the forest in mid-April, he was my guy. I mean, it was incredible. But all of that said, I would not risk your life going into the forest with me because it probably wouldn't end well.
And if you're not grounding up leaves at home and berries or any of that. Okay.
How did you connect with the brother, the 94-year-old? How did that happen?
Oh gosh, I don't remember how I wound up finding him.
Okay.
You know, I think I had heard that he lived in the United States, and it actually turned out that he lives just a couple of hours away from me in Florida, which is crazy, right?
Like, that's crazy. Okay.
It's weird. It's one of these many things that made me feel like, okay, this was obviously the book I was meant to write. You know, I think I found him through, he had written a memoir years ago.
Okay.
And I think I found him through the person who had co-authored that with him. So, it was just an incredible opportunity to get to talk to him. And again, bringing up superheroes, but it truly felt like speaking to a superhero. The group that he was a part of, that he and his brothers started, not only survived themselves, but one of his jobs was to go into the Jewish ghettos and to solicit people, to bring people out, to say, if you stay here, you won't survive. Come with us. So, I mean, they saved hundreds of lives. It's staggering.
How courageous. You know?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, again, when I started the book, Julie, I'm sure you felt the same. I had no idea. Like,
I had never heard this tale.
So as you said, learning, but multidimensional, great character development. Congratulations. It's just a wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
What are you working on next? Because I know you over at Friends in Fiction, you all publish about 22 books a year, as far as I can tell. I mean, there's kids books and Christmas books. And my gosh, you're just the busiest group of writers ever. What's the next one about?
That is a great question.
Okay.
I'm writing it now. It'll be out next summer. I think it's scheduled to be out next summer. I'm at that very beginning part of it
all
now.
Right.
Where I'm just trying to connect the dots, but it's World War II France, because as you noted, I cannot seem to stop writing about World War II. But it's a return to World War II France, which several of my other novels have been set in and around Paris during World War II. So this one is about motherhood and a lost daughter during the war.
Okay. Okay. We're already in. Julie and I are already
signed up.
Well, speaking of motherhood, you wrote a piece from Parade magazine about being home over the last year with your 4-year-old and about what you lost, but also about what you gained. And I think a lot of working moms can relate. What was one of the positive parts about being home with a 4-year-old while you were trying to work? And are you looking forward to the fall?
Well, I'm looking forward to having a lot more available time in the fall. Thank you for the question. One of the neat things about Friends in Fiction is we do write a weekly column for parade.com. We take turns doing that. And that was probably the most personal essay I've ever written. I have a really hard time getting personal about myself. It's really strange. But It was a challenging year. Noah is 5 now. He'll be starting kindergarten in the fall. And I have a lot of doubts that, you know, I don't know if I did the right thing. We kept him home this year, which was a challenge for us and a challenge for him. And I know there were things that he probably missed out on. And we kept him home because of the pandemic, and it just never quite felt right to us. But you asked what was one good positive part? And you know, I will say two things. One, I get to spend all of this time with him that I wouldn't have otherwise had, which sometimes felt difficult because it took me away from work I needed to be doing. But what a gift. I mean, what a gift to get this whole extra year with my sweet, wonderful little child as he's developing. And then number two, I get to teach him to read. And if it had not been for this year, he would have learned that in a classroom. You know, I would have had a second row seat to it. I would have seen him coming home with all of that new discovery lighting up his eyes. But I got to sit there at our kitchen table and see as the dots connected in his head. And I mean, he can read short chapter books now. And that happened. That happened over the course of this year, though. And just to be able to be a part of that, I think it's something I'll never forget. And you know, there were beautiful things that came out of this tough time.
Right. That's good. No, that's really magical to see.
Julie tried to teach her grandson to read. No luck, right, Julie?
No, that is harsh and cruel, sister. Okay. I did take over kindergarten for my kindergarten grandson, and he did just fine in the reading lane.
Okay, good. You said it was hard though.
Yes, it was very hard.
It was very hard.
I felt an enormous sense of responsibility. Like if he didn't know how to read, it was on my watch, Kristen.
Well, you know, Julie, I felt like that too. I think that was a big part of what I really struggled with this year was just that thought of, am I doing it right? Am I giving him what he needs? And you know, I don't know, but at least he can read. So I might have screwed him up 10 other ways, but at least he can read.
Well, seriously, speaking of superheroes, all those parents at home with the pandemic doing the schooling and the working and all those kids that slogged through. So I'm excited for him to start kindergarten. I'm excited for you. That'll be a great first day of school picture. One that you'll cherish forever.
Yes.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such a pleasure. Really fun to learn about your background, and we love everything you're doing over at Friends in Fiction, and we'll keep tuning in. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liz, summer is coming up, and you know what that means? It means you're grilling and chilling there with your butcher box. What do you got going on the grill this summer?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Because I'm going to be up in Bend for a part of the summer, I'm having my box sent there, Leanne.
That's great.
Go on vacation with your butcher box is what I'm recommending. Yeah, either way, you're just going to buy meat and fish and stuff when you get there. Why do that? Anyway. I love their steaks. I love their scallops. The scallops are really good. And the chicken thighs, all good. I'm ready.
That's right. Butcher Box gives you peace of mind and easy to find high quality meat and seafood you can trust. It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork that's raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. No antibiotics or added hormones. And as Liz said, delivered right to your doorstep. And you can customize that delivery plan, Liz, right? Because it can go wherever you want it to go, whenever you want it to go. If you want to delay it a week, you know, speed it up a week, you just go to your ButcherBox account and you can make that all happen.
It's so easy to manage online.
Yeah. And if you're like Liz, you can take your ButcherBox on vacation, which is... That's nice to have something familiar there.
Yes.
So if you want to take your meat on vacation, sign up at butcherbox.com/sisters and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. So you can choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/sisters and use code SISTERS to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order. Thanks, ButcherBox.
It is a pleasure to welcome to Satellite Sisters the third of the Fab Five that we're interviewing today from Friends in Fiction, Christy Woodson Harvey. Her latest book, Under a Southern Sky, is a New York Times bestseller. She writes wonderful contemporary fiction that has a real sense of place. It's both, you know, literally and literaturely. You are right there in her book, Spending Summer in the Carolinas. And we are so happy to welcome Christy to Satellite Sisters. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Christy. Hi. Thank you all so much for having me today. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, this is great. Well, Christy, we want to start first with the book, and then we're going to get to some other personal questions. In this book, Under a Southern Sky, and also in my sister Leanne's book, in the Sweeney Sisters, you use a scientific development. In your case, and for Under the Southern Sky, frozen embryos, and Leanne has a DNA discovery in her book. that set in motion the characters and how they have to respond to it. Why did you choose that as a storyline?
That is such a good question. And gosh, I love all these scientific developments. It's giving us really great things to write about, right, Leanne?
Right. That's true. New stories. Yeah. New families. New situations, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And so actually, the idea came to me through a friend, which is always really fun. And it was actually 5 or 6 years ago, we were at a party and she and her husband were making a really difficult decision about, you know, what they were going to do with their leftover frozen embryos. And it wasn't something that they had thought about before they started doing IVF. And so they were just, you know, having a hard time. And she was just talking to me about it. And she said, you know, you should write a book about this because a lot of people are going to be going through this. Mm. And right away, I knew that I would. I thought, yes, that is definitely something that I want to write a book about. But, you know, it's a pretty broad topic. I mean, that's not really a story idea necessarily. And so, you know, I played around with it for a couple of years. I had other projects in the works and, then got contracted for the Peachtree Bluff series kind of by surprise. So it was something I had had in my back pocket for a few years. And then I knew it was time. I knew I wanted to write about it and I knew it was time. And, I knew that someone needed to have passed away for this to be sort of high stakes enough to write a story about it.
Okay.
So that was a part of it. And then, strangely enough, I had another really good friend who I had been talking to about this story and about this idea I had about, you know, this wife that had passed away and, you know, this husband left to make this really difficult decision. And she called me and said, well, if you were waiting for a sign, I have your sign. And I was like, oh, what? And she was in PA school. She had just delivered her first baby and it was, the father, you know, had the baby with frozen embryos via a surrogate because his wife had died. And I was like, okay, it's time to write the story. Oh, wow. So it was very cool that we had just been talking about that. And then that happened. And I thought, okay, well, this is realistic then. So let's go.
Yeah. Oh, that gives me chills. I know, but it is such a modern dilemma. And I think how you treated it in the book was just beautiful. So
thank you.
You know, a big part of your books is the sense of place in the South. And I know after I read your books, I just really want to move to a beach town and live in one of those fabulous houses that you describe. How do you create that in your work? You know, how do you create, I mean, do other readers say, hey, can I move to North Carolina, you know, and live in that house or whatever? You know?
Well, I think the best example is that I influenced myself.
Okay, that's fun.
I was writing the Peachtree Bluff series and I based it off of Beaufort, North Carolina, which is this town on the coast. And we had a house there and we'd spent a couple years redoing it and we just loved it. And I remember one day like looking up at my husband and being like, wait, why don't we live here? I mean, these people live here in Peachtree Bluff. And he's like, yeah, why don't we? And so we hatched this plan that we were going to move for a year because our son was in preschool and we were like, we can figure this out for a year. And then we never left. So.
Oh my gosh. That's a good story. I didn't know that.
Wow. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So you have made my dream come true. Thank you very much.
but no, I mean, I do think in some ways that's kind of the dream. And it really, in a very practical way, I do think it's helped my writing. I mean, I love being able to, you know, see the water and the wild horses and all these things that I sort of write about on a daily basis. I think to live in them, it really does influence your writing and it really does help inspire those stories. So I guess the short answer would be that, I mean, I think just living here and realizing how very, very different, I mean, you can drive a mile away or be on a boat a mile away from somewhere where you normally are and have a totally different setting for a story. And so that's been a really cool thing too, to be able to kind of, you know, bounce around and to different places and get a whole new setting.
Do you think you'll always stay with the South as a setting, or can we expect a book in Paris sometime soon?
Oh, that would be great. Can we go to Paris again yet? I like that idea. So I don't know. I mean, I definitely can see myself writing about places that were not the South, but I would for sure write about them from an outsider perspective. I think that's kind of important. I know, for example, like I have this really good friend that lives in the Midwest and I'll read her books, you know, they're all set in Wisconsin. And I'll think if I set a book in Wisconsin and I talked about a bubbler, I would have called it a water fountain, you know?
Right,
so
right.
I think it's hard to write about places from an insider perspective that you don't really know, but I would love to write about, you know, a Southerner going to another place for sure.
Okay.
And I love writing about, you know, any place that I can see kind of from an outsider perspective, but I have really realized that I think you can tell when someone writes about a place that they do not intimately know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I
you
think
can.
You're right. And that's that what comes through is your love of the South and that you really do know the South. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Southern manners, because the dialogue, the characters you create, they just seem of the place, as well as the beach houses where we want to move in.
Yes. Yes. Well, it does make me laugh because there'll be notes from my editor sometimes like, why doesn't she just come out and say this? And my response will be, because she's a Southern lady and they don't do that. Just, you know, very specific. There are very specific things I think about, you know, growing up in the South that you pick up on and that are kind of interesting. So,
well, one of the reasons your books have such a sense of place is like, that is your other career. You have a whole nother life with your mom. You created Design Chic, which is like a top design blog. It's you're in the Design Blogger Hall of Fame, Christy. Congratulations. First of all,
right.
Sponsored by Traditional Home, one of our favorite magazines. Isn't it, Joel?
Yes.
We love Traditional Home.
I know. Weren't we scheming at one point to see if Traditional Homes would redo my house?
Yes, we were.
There was no uptake on that.
We did that pitch. Yeah.
I wish they would do mine too. That would be fantastic.
But how did that start with your mom? I mean, it's such a great, we were just on it, looking at a home in Julie's neighborhood. You have a house tour of a house in Julie's neighborhood in Dallas.
Yes.
Well, you know, it started as a lot of good things do, just kind of by accident, I think. So about, 11 years ago, it blows my mind. We've been doing it 11 years, but we were both redoing houses at the time. And I was actually working in finance and I missed writing and I was trying to kind of get back into writing in some ways. And I was doing some freelance stuff. And my mom called me one day and told me that she wanted to learn something new, which I just found hilarious. And she was like, yeah, I feel like I need like a new skill. I feel like I'm like, you know, I want to like challenge my brain. I was like, oh gosh. Okay. And so then she said, as you know, what comes next. So what are we going to do? I was like, okay. So I'm going to challenge my brain too. And I said, you know what? I have been doing some freelance pieces for these blogs and they're like kind of this thing, like we should start a blog. And she said, that sounds perfect. What's a blog?
Yeah, it's great.
So I think we've all been there. We all ask.
Yeah. What's a podcast?
Right?
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start a podcast. When the world's a podcast. Mm-hmm. But so we started the blog and we thought, you know, we would do it for like 6 months or something. When we were finished redoing these houses, we would be done with it. And, you know, I think what it really boils down to is the fact that we hit it at a really great time. I mean, 11 years ago, blogs were a big thing, but every person on the planet didn't have one.
Right.
Probably
right.
Kind of like you guys. I mean, you know, you've, I mean, not to set aside your amazing talent because you are amazingly talented, but I do think sometimes, you know, when you can hit things at the right time, it keeps you going. It keeps you motivated.
Yes. Yeah.
And so we were growing fairly quickly. And so after 6 months, we thought, well, gosh, we have like people reading this now and like we know them. I mean, we can't just stop now. And so we kept being like, all right, well, we'll reassess next year. And here we are 11 reassessments later and we're still doing it. So it's been a lot of fun. We've learned a lot. It's definitely evolved over time. Things have changed. The internet's changed. The world has changed and it will continue to. So, you know, we're hanging in there as long as we can and we're still really enjoying it.
You know, people ask us all the time, what is it like to work with your real sisters? So, mm-hmm. and we have a standard answer that we, you know, if we all worked in the same place, we would kill each other, but we don't. That's the whole beauty of Satellite Sisters. But what's it like to work with your mom?
So it's really amazing. And this is my true answer. This is not my like PC answer. I really do mean this because if I was going to tell anyone like, oh, it's awful, I would tell you guys, but it's not, it's really great. And the reason I say that is because she is so intimately aware of my schedule. So like, she's already thinking about the fact like, okay, Christy's going to be on tour for Christmas in Peachtree Bluff for 5 weeks in October. We've got to go ahead and get that content ready to go. You know, like she's so aware of like what's going on, and she'll know like, okay, you know, I'm on deadline and I'm crazy. And she'll be like, all right, we're not going to schedule any sponsored posts for that week because who knows if Christy's going to show up. You know, I mean, right, she's really right. good about
She's so, your mom and she really supports you and yes. she's so proud of your writing so, career, right?
She's amazing. She's amazing. And I do think, you know, the writing and the blog have fed each other really well. Like I think in the beginning, the blog fed my books. And I think now it kind of works the other way as well, which has been really great. So, and you know, she's just so great to work with. And if I had done it with anyone else, I would have had to quit a long time ago because there are those peaks and valleys where I just don't have as much time to devote to it. And she picks up so much slack during those times that I don't have as much time. And then, you know, everything's a cycle and then I'll be really into it and, you know, be great and really ahead and all that stuff and have all these new ideas. And, you know, that cycle comes too, but she's amazing. She's so great. And she's so good at it. She has such a good eye. And just is, she's so great at working with like all the designers and the photographers, and she's so organized and she's all the things I'm not. So that's good.
Well, I mean, I think people don't understand how much work a blog is. A blog right. like yours, where it's really a hands-on thing. You're not, this is not someone's corporate blog. It's the two of you. Right. And it just chews up content. I mean, that's what I say to people. Like, if you go into it, you just have to be ready to really post, or else there's no there. You know, you have to post a couple times a week. So
exactly.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well,
yeah.
And this is going to blow your mind, but we post 7 days a week and have for, I think for the last like 6 years, we've posted 7 days a week.
Are you like Monday, Tuesday, Friday? And I mean, do you have certain days of the week or it's
no,
just,
so,
it depends on your schedule?
No. So we have certain, we just have like certain jobs that we do, if that makes sense. So, mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter. I mean, we have certain, you know, certain things that we each do like no matter the day. So it's just sort of split up that way. But, it's crazy. But, and you know, when we started it, the internet was the Wild Wild West.
Right.
You could take anything you wanted. I mean, you just were out there and you just picked up whatever you wanted. And of course now it's evolved to, you know, sign permission for every photo and, you know, those types of things. So it's definitely, it's a very different animal than it was 11 years ago.
Well, I think you and your mom have learned some things in the last 11 years.
Yeah, good job. Yes, okay. we will put a link to Christy's blog in the show notes. You can reach it at mydesignchic.com. The blog is Design Chic. And also totally worth following Christy on Instagram because just beautiful houses. Like I think Instagram is great for dogs, gardens, and houses. You know, that's my... Mainly
I was
going to
say, yesterday we posted a dog in a house, and that is, we were like, why are we doing houses? We should just have a dog Instagram. That's all we should do is dogs, because people absolutely lost their minds about the dog. So we were like, okay, dog Instagram, new strategy.
So before you go, we need to ask though, you mentioned, quote, the Christmas book. I mean... You people, you're just writing your heads off over there at Friends of Fiction. So is this your first Christmas book? And how does that happen? I'd like to get on the Christmas book schedule. Yes. What happened there? How did
get
that
on the
out?
Christmas book schedule? That happened because it was COVID and I forgot myself and lost my mind is what happened. Okay. So December, it was truly December. And, you know, we were starting all the like Christmas holiday season kind of things. And of course nothing was happening because it was COVID and we couldn't have parades and we couldn't have tree lightings. And I was like, just really down in the dumps about it because I love Christmas so much. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a Christmas book. That this is how I'm going to pull myself out of my Christmas depression is I am going to write. I mean, I shouldn't use that term lightly. I was fine. Everything was fine, but it was COVID, you know, so it was crazy.
Right.
And so I just said, I thought I'm going to write a Christmas book and I'm going to write about everything that I wish we were doing right now. And then I was like, well, it has to be a Peachtree Bluff book because I'd had so many, 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 many requests from people over the past few months to write more Peachtree Bluff. And I was like, well, this is perfect. We can go back to Peachtree Bluff. I can get my Christmas fix. And so I literally called my editor in like it was early December. And I said, what do you think about if I write another Peachtree Bluff book? And she was like, oh my gosh, yes, please write another Peachtree Bluff book. And I said, so let's put it out Christmas 2022. And she said, well, let's put it out Christmas 2021. And I was like, what? No, like, how am I going to possibly do that? And she was like, well, you just said you aren't doing anything. So write the book. So I did. But I really, it was so fun and it was so easy to write because I would be like, I would get up and I'd be like, okay, so today we would be having the flotilla, which is like the boat parade. And I'm like, I'm going to write a scene set at the boat parade. But, no, it was really fun to write. And it's for people who have not read the Peachtree Bluff series, the series is about these three grown sisters and their mother and a big secret from their past that has the potential to reshape what it means for them to be a family. And it's set in this quaint, quirky, beautiful coastal Georgia town that's based on Beaufort, North Carolina, where I actually live. And so that's the story. But each of the books in the series is Ansley, who is the mother of these daughters, is the protagonist of all three books. And then each daughter had a chance to sort of tell her side of the story in one of the three books. And so in this one, Caroline, who's the eldest daughter's daughter, is 15 years old, Vivi. And so she kind of sets this story into motion because there's a big hurricane coming toward Peachtree Bluff. And Vivi gets herself, her grandmother Ansley, and her step-grandfather Jack stuck in Peachtree Bluff during the storm of the century. Ooh. So that's how the story starts. And then, of course, the sisters kind of have to figure out how to get back to Peachtree Bluff, and then they all sort of have to rebuild just in time for the holidays. So there is some plot going on there, but it was so fun, and it's just, I think it's a really feel-good story. And you don't have to have read the Peachtree Bluff series to understand this book.
You can just jump in at Christmas time if you like Christmas.
Okay. If you like Christmas, just jump in, read about the Christmas trees and smile, and you know.
All right, so because we talked to Mary Alice in the beginning of this podcast, and she told us the behind the scenes story of how The Beach House became a Hallmark movie, how she managed to literally chase down Andy McDonald in an airport.
Yes.
And, like, force the book on her, and Andy bought the book. So who are you going to chase down for this Christmas book?
I have to tell you a really funny story, and I can't tell you everything, but I can tell you this part because this is like very fine and out there. So when the last book in the Peachtree Bluff series came out, so this was in like 2019, a producer at CBS sent an email to someone at Simon & Schuster and said, I want like a really fun, like blue sky, happy series. And they sent her Peachtree Bluff, and she said, and she says this all the time, and it's so funny. She's like, I picked these up and I was like, oh, that's like an old lady, like romance series. Great. This is exactly what I don't want. And then she started reading it and she really loved it. And as it turned out, she grew up 30 minutes away from where this book is, like, you know, the real town that this book is fictionally set in. So, you know, it is. And so she ended up optioning but all the books in the series and
oh great
so on That's and so good. Forth so good. So it's gone really well, and I'm hoping we can, you know, talk about it a little bit more later, but
okay, excellent, fantastic.
Yeah, but I just thought, what a small world that is. Like, what are the chances that of all the books produced by Simon & Schuster in a given year, someone would have sent her the Peachtree Bluff series, that, you know, she's living in LA, that she would happened to be from North Carolina and like found out the backstory. So, you know, it's just a small world. You never know what's going to happen, but I do feel like those things are sort of serendipitous. And it's just been amazing to meet her and like have this new friend. So no matter what happens, you know, we've had a really good time.
Oh, congratulations. That's fun. That is a good story too. That's an excellent story too. So battle of the fantastic stories between you and Well, Christy, thank you so much for being on Satellite Sisters. What a delight to talk to all three of you today, three of the five friends and fiction women. And we've just so enjoyed getting to know you all over the last year, and continued success. We look forward to this Christmas book.
Thank you, Christy. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for all of your help. Y'all have been such an inspiration for us. You've given us so much good advice, and we're so appreciative and in awe of what you do. So thank you for letting us be a part of it.
Thanks.